From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Ward Connerly, the Sacramento businessman who has long campaigned against affirmative action and other race-based programs, is stepping down from the University of California Board of Regents. He was appointed to a 12-year term back in 1993 by then-Governor Pete Wilson. It was at UC that Connerly became nationally known when he persuaded the Board of Regents to stop using race as a factor in admissions to the university. In the process, he attracted strong criticism from supporters of affirmative action. Ward Connerly also chaired Proposition 209, which ended public affirmative action programs in California. That was approved by voters in 1996. Ward Connerly is now working on a similar initiative campaign in Michigan. And he's my guest today on Insight. If you have questions, call us at 888-345-5959 or email us at insight@capradio.org. Ward Connerly, thank you very much for joining me.
Glad to be with you.
Well, how do you feel looking back over your 12 years on the UC Board of Regents? It was a fairly eventful period of time. What's the high point as you look back on it?
Well, I think the high point really was returning the university to the point at which it should have been, which is to honor the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Sometimes we forget when we talk about diversity and affirmative action that the tumultuous period known as the Civil Rights Era really resulted in our most crowning achievement, which was the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The 1964 Civil Rights Act guarantees that every American will be treated equally, and I quote here, without regard to race, color, or creed. And so by my saying to the university as a regent, you shouldn't be using race to discriminate against people or give anyone extra points on the basis of that. All I was doing was saying, let's live by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It should not have been a controversial period in the university's history. But it was, and I think that despite the criticism of some, I regard that as my the high point of my 12-year sentence as a regent.
Your sentence?
Yes.
What about the low point, or let me just say, what was the toughest period or moment for you when you were on the board?
The toughest periods really involve sitting at board meetings and being taunted and called names, Uncle Tom and the like, without being able to respond to those individuals. There is a merry band of individuals that came to just about every meeting and made it their point to make sure that I didn't have a nice day. And our protocol is such that you don't respond as a regent to any kind of public comment. And as a result, I would sit and seethe in anger. I did not want to walk out of the room. That's not what I like to do. So that was a real tough point to, and it happened frequently.
My guest is Ward Connerly. He's, among other things, the founder and chairman of the American Civil Rights Institute, which works to undo racial preferences in the United States. And he's ending his 12-year term on the University of California Board of Regents. When you joined the Regents in 1993, what was your goal? Was it to work on what you made a national name for yourself in, which was undoing or attempting to undo the affirmative action programs at the university?
Let me make one correction. I have not undone affirmative action. I have undone racial preferences.
Yes.
There are many forms of affirmative action that are acceptable. I applaud them and promote them. But I entered the university arena with no agenda in mind, although some of my critics like to portray the political perspective that I came there with an agenda given to me by Governor Pete Wilson. That is absolutely not true. I went there, I didn't seek to become a regent, and I went there with the sole objective of doing the best job that I could for the people of California. But I had no agenda.
What did Governor Wilson say to you then when he contacted you and asked you to serve on the UC board?
I want you to serve on the Board of Regents. Would you be willing to do it?
What kind of relationship had you had with Governor Wilson? Had you been involved with him politically, socially?
I'd known the governor since 1969. I had been his chief of staff on the housing committee. We were very close personal friends. I had contributed heavily to him. And that, frankly, is the way most people become regents. No one goes there that I can think of with any agenda. No one is told by the governor, this is what I want you to do. When you have arrived at that point and you're appointed to a 12-year term and you can't be replaced by any governor, no one feels any sense of obligation to the appointing power. And that's one of the things that those who criticize different regents just don't seem to understand. You cannot be removed. Therefore, you have no obligation to anyone except yourself.
If you had no agenda when you started out on the board and Governor Wilson didn't say what he hoped from you as a member of the board, with this 12-year term stretching off into the distance, why did you agree to do it when you obviously have a thriving business as it is?
I think that most people who have become successful do have some sense, you know, varying degrees of public service, of public giving something back. And being a member of the Board of Regents is arguably one of the most prestigious appointments that one can receive in this state. Other than the Supreme Court, there is no other body in California that is in the state constitution. And so I accepted it for that reason and that reason alone. I did not think it was going to take as much time as it did.
How much time did it take?
It takes about 20 hours a week, average, every week. I've been chair of the finance committees, the audit committee, the ed policy committee, the nominating committee, and all of those things require you to spend an awful lot of time reading materials and attending meetings. The University of California consists of 9 undergraduate campuses, 3 hospitals, 5 law schools, 3 laboratories. It is a multi-billion dollar enterprise that requires an awful lot of time to govern it.
Given everything that's happened since you became a member of the board, are you surprised now? Are you looking back on where you were when you started on the board? Would you have been surprised then at how things turned out, what you got involved in, how you became known?
Yes, I was a pretty low profile kind of guy. I would contribute heavily to political campaigns, but I like to take the quiet route of not really being out front. I have a very successful business here in Sacramento, and it's the nature of people in business that you sort of believe that the quieter you are, the more green you're going to be able to amass in business. And so I did not seek any kind of publicity or high profile. But one of the things I learned is that you are a fiduciary. You have certain legal obligations. And one of those legal obligations is to comply with the constitution of this state and of the country and the laws of the land. The 1964 Civil Rights Act has not been repealed. And once I had discovered that the university was indeed giving people extra points in San Diego, if you were black or Latino or Native American, you automatically received 300 bonus points. That is discrimination against Asians and whites and anyone else who is not one of those 3 underrepresented groups. Once I discovered that, I could not ignore it. As a fiduciary, you have to act on those things that come to your attention.
The goal, I think, behind the race-based admission process was to increase the number of blacks and Hispanics in the university to bring them at least up to their proportion in society because of what was perceived to be a social benefit of having our universities approximate to our community at large. That was the goal behind race-based admissions. Do you feel like it went too far, or do you feel like it was flawed from the start?
Well, that can be a goal. I mean, it's one thing to have a goal. It's something else to do things that are illegal to achieve that goal. Not only is it illegal, I think it's immoral. I think that it presumes that black people and Latinos cannot compete alongside Asians and whites unless you give them some special consideration. I think that's wrong. And so one thing that I really believe very strongly is that it's one thing to have the goal. It's something else to act on that goal in ways that are legally impermissible. Discrimination against people or discrimination in favor of them, and it's just the opposite side of the coin, is illegal. In this country, the 64 Civil Rights Act is the law of the land. It has not been repealed. And the Supreme Court, which has on occasion said, well, you can use race to achieve diversity, is not the Congress. It is not supposed to be writing law.
You said that it's wrong to think or to act that that blacks and Latinos can't compete with whites and Asians, and it's obviously correct that there's no innate reason why one group should be smarter or more disciplined than another. However, it is definitely harder to compete when you come from a disadvantaged background, a tough neighborhood, and blacks and Latinos disproportionately relative to whites and Asians come from neighborhoods like that. And again, I think that's one of the goals behind race-based admissions, is to at least try and correct the disadvantaged backgrounds.
Well, I have no problem with correcting disadvantaged backgrounds. It's when you start making race and disadvantaged backgrounds interchangeable. There are an awful lot of poor whites in this state. There are an awful lot of poor Asians in this state. They go to the same schools in many cases as blacks and Latinos. So I think that it is appropriate to have affirmative action, if you will, based on socioeconomic conditions rather than on the basis of race and skin color.
And how would that work? Or how does that work?
You can give preference, if you want, to children who have never had a parent go to college. You can give preference, if you will, to those who are low income. You can give it to those who go to certain schools that may not have access to the honors courses and all of those things that allow one to be more competitive at the University of California. There are any number of things that you can do that are not related to race or color that I think are permissible forms of affirmative action.
Is that what UC is doing now with what's called, I believe, the Comprehensive Review?
Yes, that's precisely what we're doing, and I'm very proud of that because it allows us to look at students as individuals on their own merits without saying that because you're black, therefore you must be disadvantaged and we're going to give you a preference.
After the ban on race-based admissions took effect, there were dips in the admissions of African-American students, Latinos, and some others. In fact, I think that actually the number of white students dipped as well in 1998 at the University of California. Numbers of ethnic minorities have risen back up again, but I understand that at Berkeley and UCLA, the numbers are still down for admissions of African Americans and Latinos. Why is that?
Because there is an academic gap between blacks and Latinos on the one hand and Asians and whites on the other. And we had been closing that gap at the University of California prior to my arrival by a stroke of the pen, just simply giving them more points to bring them up to the point of being competitive alongside Asians and whites. And so I believe that, yes, we want to close that gap, and individuals need to be doing that. Their families need to be getting them on a college path from the point that they leave the womb, I believe. And we need to improve the K-12 system. But you don't correct that gap by simply giving people extra points and having a different standard for some in relation to others. That is exactly what we had been doing. And the fact that there was what you called a dip is as a result of the points that we'd been giving in the first place. The numbers were artificially higher than they otherwise would have been if you just simply used equal measures for all of the different groups.
I'm talking with Ward Connerly. Were you surprised that the University of California board sided with you on race-based admissions back in 95? There is a strong constituency in favor of race-based admissions in the universities.
I was surprised to some extent because political correctness is a great illness in this country. And I wasn't the first one to realize that the University of California was using preferences. The first one to go out on a limb and say, let's not do this. But I was somewhat surprised that they went along with me. My objective, though, as a region, has never been to be guided by whether I would be alone or not, but rather to do what I thought was right and hope that the truth would set the others free.
We should note that the UC Board of Regents voted to repeal the ban on race-based admissions in 2001. What happened there?
There was an argument that having it on the books imposed by the Board of Regents was making it unwelcome, sending an unwelcome message for a lot of blacks and Latinos that they weren't even applying because this was on the books. I thought it was a phony argument, but in view of the fact that Proposition 209 had been passed by the voters and was overriding the action that I had urged the board to take back in 1995, I went along and voted with that reversal of SP1.
Because the board voted to repeal race-based admissions, but they still don't have race-based admissions.
That's because of Proposition 209.
Are you saying that it was just a symbolic vote to repeal race-based admissions?
Yeah, that's all it was. It was a symbolic vote to repeal SP1. SP1 was a resolution that I put forward in 1995. It was subsequently overridden, if you will, by Proposition 209 in 1996.
This is Insight from KXJZ. My guest today is Ward Connolly. He's nationally known for his campaigns against some forms of affirmative action. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can listen to today's show and any other Insight Archive program on our website. Go to campradio.org/insight. My guest today is Ward Connolly, stepping down at the end of his 12-year term on the University of California's Board of Regents. Ward Connolly led the campaign to end race in admissions at the university. He also chaired California's Proposition 209 in 1996 to end public affirmative action programs in the state of California. He's working on a similar initiative campaign in Michigan. You might be stepping down from the UC Board of Regents, but you're still you're very much in the news. In fact, on the program that was on before ours, the Tony Cox's program, which is the successor to Tavis Smiley, he had a roundtable with some reporters, including Rochelle Riley of the Detroit Free Press. Here's what she said.
As for Ward Connolly, California's dream, getting rid of him, becomes Michigan's nightmare because this state gets him. This becomes his next battleground.
That's Rochelle Riley speaking with Tony Cox just about an hour ago. Comments like that go back a long way. I was, when researching for this program, found some cartoons about you. One is shows you dangling like a puppet on strings, and another cartoon on the black commentator, you're striding in the direction pointed by a sign that says separate but equal, and you're saying to dare to go where no white supremacist regent has gone before. And also I read a review of your book in Amazon.com where this person wrote, if this guy got his way, black people would return to the days of kissing the boots of whites and proclaiming, yes, master. If you want to know what self-hatred is, this guy defines it. And there are many, many other similar examples, as of course you know. Why do you think that you attract so much criticism and so much of it so personal?
Race is an industry. And there are people who will go to any extreme to make sure that that industry is not harmed. The monoracialists, as I call them, the people who believe that race is pure and that they don't acknowledge multiracial identity, these folks belong to the NAACP. They are journalists in many cases. They're ethnic studies professors. They will go to any extreme to defend their turf. If you really look at what I've been promoting, it is nothing more than the 1964 Civil Rights Act. They're the ones that ought to have to account for discrimination, wanting to sanction discrimination. I shouldn't be controversial, but I'm not going to back off and shrink because these people are so infantile as to call names. There are ways that we can have a civil debate in this society without demonizing people, without calling people names.
How do you sustain yourself in the face of that criticism, setting aside the debate over, you know, the pros and cons of race-based admissions and so on? It's got to be tough listening to and reading and seeing this kind of thing.
Sure it is, but I consider the source. Sure, I can see the anger, but I'm not going to walk away from the fight because there are people who believe that the only way you can win it is to call others names. That really reflects to me the fact that they really don't have a very strong argument. When you have to call someone Uncle Tom and Puppet and all of those sorts of names, it really means that you don't have a very strong argument. Otherwise, you would be arguing it on the merits without personalizing it and calling people names.
I also found a review of your autobiography in Mother Jones, and it was written by Michelle Landis, and it was very strong in its criticism of you. At one point, she said that she accused you of, quote, slamming the doors of opportunity in the faces of millions of people of color. She's not here to defend what she says or to expand on it, but I would guess she would say, well, look at the admissions at Berkeley and UCLA. The fact of the matter is there are fewer African-American and Latino students getting into those universities. And whatever you think of race-based admissions, the reality is there are fewer of them there. And that, I guess, could be said as, quote-unquote, slamming the doors of opportunity. How would you respond to that?
The only way that you can respond to it is to acknowledge that we live in a merit-based society. Competition is tough in almost every sector of our economy. If you give people preferences, extra points, you lower the bar, and then you take those away, there's going to be a consequence to that. But giving the extra points in the first place was wrong. We still live by a law in this country, and it's the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it says that people will not be discriminated against on the basis of race. There are those who see this as a war in effect between white males on the one hand and people of color and women on the other hand. I think that is poison. I think it's dangerous for our society to be constructed that way. And those who are criticizing me are that people of color, if you will, whatever that means, coalition. They are wrong. They are dangerous. That philosophy ought to have no place in this society. John F. Kennedy said race has no place in American life or law.
I'm talking with Ward Connerly, stepping down after at the end of his 12-year term on the University of California Board of Regents. Let's go back to the mid-90s. After you persuaded the UC Board of Regents to stop race-based admissions, you became the chair of the campaign in support of what became Proposition 209. You chaired the campaign, and Proposition 209 ended public or state and local government affirmative action programs.
Preferential treatment
in California. You co-signed the official argument in favor of 209, which said, quote, special interests hijacked the civil rights movement. Could you talk more about that? How did special interests hijack it?
I think that the NAACP is a special interest. They hide behind the notion that they're trying to help disadvantaged people. They're helping middle-class people. The member who belongs to the NAACP is typically middle-class, earning over $100,000 a year, working for the government. They are not low-income people living in South Central Los Angeles or Del Paso Heights or East Oakland. They're not representing low-income people. I am all in favor of going out of our way to help those who are economically disadvantaged. But I do not favor the presupposition that all people who are black are disadvantaged or all Latinos are disadvantaged. They are a special interest, in effect a trade association, if you will, representing middle class black people. And the same thing applies for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund.
You said then, or are you saying now, that special interests hijacked the civil rights movement. Does that mean that you think also that the leaders of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s would agree with you on preferential treatment, race-based admissions, and so on?
I can't speak for them. All I can say is that if you believed in the 1960s that judging somebody on the basis of their skin color was wrong, then to be consistent, you have to believe that it's wrong now. It was wrong to discriminate against people on the basis of skin color back in the 1960s if they were black. Why is it right now to discriminate against low-income Vietnamese people or whites on the same basis? I'm just simply being consistent with all that we fought for during that period.
My guest is Ward Connerly on Insight. Could you talk more about the difference between preferential treatment and affirmative action programs?
Let's say that you want to make sure that what we call the good old boys network is broken up and you have a job opening and you advertise it broadly. You go into a black church and you inform people about the availability of that job. You go to a Cinco de Mayo parade, a celebration rather, and you promote that job availability. That's affirmative action. To say, however, that we're going to require that Asians and whites have 1,500 points to be admitted as freshmen to UC Berkeley, but if you're black or Latino, you can get in with 1,250. That's not affirmative action. That is preferential treatment. That's the distinction that that I've tried to make. I have no objection to good affirmative action programs, such making as sure that job descriptions are fair, that you don't require something for a female that you're not requiring for a male. That is affirmative action that makes sense. But when you have different standards for people, which is what most affirmative action programs have become, that's not affirmative action. That's hiding behind language. Language, that is discrimination.
The official argument in support of Prop 209 also said, and I'll quote, "Let's not perpetuate the myth that minorities and women cannot compete without special preferences," end of quote. But the reality is, for most of the nation's history, minorities and women were effectively forbidden from competing, and one could argue that it required special preferences to change the often deeply ingrained prejudices in many of the people who ran things. And still do, for the most part.
Well, one could argue that back in the 1950s and 60s and the 70s. It's hard to argue that right now. As you look at the way our society is structured right now, and some of the most successful people in our society are black. Oprah Winfrey's and the like are not people who need any special privilege. I think that we have evolved into a society where if we want to deal with these kind of problems, we have to look at it in terms of economic haves and economic have-nots. That, I think, is a more appropriate way of using the powers of government, the levers of government, to help people, rather than presuming that all of those who are of a certain skin color or group are disadvantaged.
You became well-known in this field with your campaign against race-based admissions at the University of California, but you've also been heavily involved in racial classification. You were involved in an initiative in 2003 that would have stopped the state of California from collecting racial data about the people in the state. Now, in an essay that you wrote in 2002, you wrote that racial classifications, quote, "establish dependency programs that encourage mediocrity and dilute our competitive spirit," end of quote. Would you be okay with racial classifications if there were no, quote unquote, dependency programs arising from them?
No, I oppose classifying human beings, classifying the extended human family into racial groupings, if you will. I just oppose that. I think it's wrong. I think it's immoral, and increasingly, it's becoming almost impossible to do. It's hard to walk out on the streets of Sacramento, let's say, and pick 20 people and say, "I believe that person is," and then you can fill in the blank. That's black. What is black? Is it skin color? No longer, I think, can you readily do that. So I would rather that the government get itself out of the business of classifying people. If you think that you are one thing, whatever that is, that's your business. The government shouldn't be involved in that. And the real problem I have, the other problem I have, is that the government does not acknowledge multiracial identity. You can check as many of those race boxes as you want, according to the U.S. Census. But if any one of those is black, then you are black. That's the one-drop rule. No matter what Tiger Woods says about, "I am Thai, I am American Indian, I am white, I am African," no matter what he says, no matter the fact that he checks four different boxes, if one of those boxes is black, the government arbitrarily decides that you are black. I have multiracial kids, and I think that they should have the right, they should have the freedom to be whatever they want to be. The government should not, in a Nazi-like fashion, define what they are.
Do you think that your own multiracial background and family today has influenced your thinking on this matter? Or if you were solely, as far as you knew, of black descent, that you might feel differently about racial classification?
I'm not sure if it's attributable to that or whether it's attributable to my libertarian leanings, if you will, that the government should not be involved in those areas where it is not critical that the government be there, national defense or whatever. I just think that this is one of those areas that once the government got in, and it got in for the wrong purposes, to define black people according to the three-fifths rule so that property would remain in the hands of slave owners, that's really why the government is involved in racial classification. Once it got involved in that, it's very difficult to extricate itself from that.
My guest is Ward Connerly. What about medical research as it relates to racial classification? I understand that there are many ailments and syndromes that do have some connection, apparently, to race or ethnicity. I believe that African-Americans are more prone to diabetes, for example. Isn't there a place for racial classification and ethnic classification in order to make sure that research and care are administered properly?
Well, first of all, Proposition 54, which is an initiative that you've referred to earlier, had an exemption for medical research.
Yes, I do know that, but just in general.
Well, I'm not so sure that, because I'm not a physician, but I'm not so sure that these illnesses are endemic to, quote, race, which increasingly people are saying is not pure, it's not real as such, social, some say. I'm not so sure that these illnesses are endemic to race and skin color or whether it's culture and habits of what people eat and their social and cultural habits. I just don't know. I would not want my doctor diagnosing me on the basis of what he believes my race is.
Yes. Do you think race exists? And if so, what is it?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think it does. If it is fixed, if it is constant, how does one account for the fact that my children who are of African descent and Irish and Choctaw and two of them are part Vietnamese? I mean, how do you account for that and where do you place them? Where do you say that they are this or they are that? And we're not unlike many other Californians who are mixed and in that melting pot and coming out far different than we went in. I personally believe that race is not real, but I know that there is a dispute about that, a real serious dispute about that. But my belief is that we're just one human race coming from different parts of the globe, different backgrounds, different experiences, but not racial in that context.
Well, if race and ethnicity are unimportant distinctions because they're not chosen and are accidents of birth, then doesn't the same also apply to nationality? I mean, no one chooses to be born anywhere. And so what does it mean to be American, for example, just because you were born here? Isn't that an accident of birth too?
I suppose it is, but it is a changeable thing. It is not immutable. It is something that one can change. Again, I don't know about race. I don't know what it is. I can't define it as such. I have my beliefs about its reality and its unreality, non-reality. But I certainly don't think that it ought to be used, whether it's real or not. It ought to be used by the government to make distinctions about people's lives and to confer benefits on the basis of it. How do you define black, for example? Is it skin color? Well, how is Colin Powell then the same race as Michael Jordan? Is it size of lips? Is it size of nose? Is it width of nose? Is it hair texture? I mean, what is race? I don't know. And so I think that it's not appropriate for the government then to have these measurements that they are going to look at people and say, oh, there's an African American. How do you know? I've seen some very curly haired white people. I've seen people from all different walks of life that defy these descriptions of race and our presumptions about race.
This is Insight from KXJZ. There's more conversation with Ward Connerly when we return. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Monday on Insight, I'll speak with experts about Governor Schwarzenegger's controversial proposal to tie teachers' salaries to performance. I'll also talk to with a public school representative from Denver, where a merit-based pay system has already been approved. I'm talking today with Ward Connerly. First, just a quick update on an earlier Insight. A few weeks ago, I interviewed a senior official at CSU Sacramento about the move to change the campus's name. And yesterday, the CSU Sacramento president, Alex Gonzalez, announced that he will ask the CSU Board of Trustees to approve changing the university's name to Sacramento State University. That could take a little while, of course, but that's the intention of Alex Gonzalez at CSU Sacramento, or Sacramento State University, as it soon will be. As I said, today I'm talking with Ward Connerly. Yesterday was his final session with the University of California Board of Regents. His 12-year term is ending. Ward Connerly is nationally known for his opposition to race-based admissions at universities and other preferential treatment programs. If you're ever asked to check a box describing your race or ethnicity, what do you choose?
I don't.
You just pass it by?
I just pass it by. I decline to state. If there was a multiracial box, I would probably check that. That's what my...
Probably.
Probably. Yeah. I would probably check that. I don't believe that the government needs to know what my ethnic background or my racial background happens to be. But if there were a multiracial option and I felt that it was important for the government somehow to have that data. And right now I can't think of any circumstance in which I believe it would be important. But if it were important, that's the box that I would check.
When did you first feel yourself rebelling or reacting against a racial classification applied to you?
I think the first time I felt this was when I got married. And at that point, there were requirements that you check these boxes in order to get a marriage license in California. My wife and I are not of the same, quote, race. And there were laws against interracial marriages back in the late 50s and 60s. We married in 1962. And so interracial marriages were just now being legalized at that period. And that's when I began to realize these distinctions that society was making and how it was intruding into personal lives by telling people that they could or could not marry on the basis of their skin color or where their ancestors came from. We both had two arms, two legs, human structure, you know, so why should the government somehow be making these distinctions between us?
You're a successful business owner. And California, as has most of the country, has had a variety of programs to favor or to help minority-owned businesses. Did you, as a business owner and someone who is commonly perceived to be black, did you ever benefit from any preferential treatment program, financially or otherwise?
Never. There was a story in the San Francisco Chronicle back in 1994, I believe, or 95, after I began this, what some call crusade, saying that I had received a minority business preference. That was contradicted by the Energy Commission, the source of the ones that were being claimed to have given me some sort of preference. My firm has never signed up as a minority business. I think it would harm our business, not help us.
Were you tempted ever?
Never tempted. In fact, just the opposite. Feeling that it would somehow accrue to our detriment. Businesses are tough. Other businesses are very competitive. Once you become known as a minority business, you limit your market.
And your business is?
Land use planning, largely. We also manage some trade associations. But race is not a factor in our business.
Let's take a call. Matt from Citrus Heights is on Insight. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hi. My name is Matt. I'm an anthropology instructor in the Sacramento area. And I was just calling because I wanted to lend some anthropological insight on the question of whether or not race is real, which you were discussing a few moments ago.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think the predominant view among anthropologists is that although race might not be real in a biological sense, That doesn't mean that it doesn't have reality in a social sense, in the sense that when we interact with people and when we meet them, we have been trained since a young age to filter our perceptions of them through this construct of race, so that it shapes the way we think about who they are and their capabilities and that sort of thing, so that in a very real way that race has a tangible existence. In that sense, it is real. It's socially real. And therefore, because of that, the argument to say that race isn't real and therefore government shouldn't have any kind of programs or responsibility in terms of dealing with that is, in a certain sense, misleading, right? Because it does have a social reality, it's certainly something that we should take into consideration in terms of our programs and policies and institutions and whatnot.
Okay, thank you very much, Matt. Ward Connolly, your reaction?
Well, I respect his anthropological background, but he goes from science to social policy. I can respect the science of this if he says that, in his opinion, race is not biologically real but socially real. Okay, fine. But does that mean that the government ought to be conferring benefits on this social reality? I believe not. And if he believes that it is, then that's what a horse race is all about. But I believe that the government should not be involved in conferring benefits on people on the basis of their race. I don't believe in profiling people, which is essentially what affirmative action flows from.
I'm talking with Ward Connolly. I read that you joined the NAACP when you were a university student. Are you still a member?
Not a member. I joined for about 1 year when I was a junior at Sacramento State University. And I terminated my membership when I became a senior, and I have not sought to renew it.
Why did you terminate your membership? Let's go back a bit. Why did you join in the first place?
Because Dr. Robert Thompson, who was the professor for whom I read as a student, had asked me to go with him to a meeting and to become a student member, and I did that. But I felt that there were no real benefits that I could find from being a member of the NAACP. My mindset was altogether different.
And what was your political, what were your political beliefs at that time, and how did you view race and ethnicity at that time?
You know, I really wasn't very conscious of race at that time, and my political views were such that I was a declined estate politically, registered as a declined estate. I supported Adlai Stevenson during that period in his run for president. But I really wasn't very conscious of racial issues at that point. That did not happen until I became a member of the Board of Regents, and when my wife and I married, and race began to hit us right smack in the face.
And now I'll go back to the question I started asking you: why did you leave the NAACP?
I didn't think that there were any benefits.
Really, just as simple as that?
Yeah, it was largely a social gathering of people, college professors and students who would meet, but there really weren't any tangible benefits to belonging.
So not because you were opposed to what they were saying or doing, just because you saw no value?
I saw no value. Time was precious. I had 1,000 other things to do, and I joined an organization because the professor had urged me to do so. And I went to maybe 2 or 3 meetings, and then I stopped going because I didn't see any benefit to going.
And what about today? Where do you stand vis-a-vis the NAACP?
You won't catch me joining for the same reason, but they have a right to join if they want. I think that the time has come where all of us need to be reevaluating these race-based organizations. Do they really, in fact, bring people together, or are they, in fact, dividing society? And so now my opposition to personally joining is based on my own assessment of whether it makes any sense to do that. But if others want to do it, God bless them. That's their right.
Let's take another call. Mike in Grass Valley, you're on Insight.
Thank you. You know, I don't know how anyone can listen to Ward for an hour and not agree with him, because it is pure rational sense. And my example would be this. What if all of a sudden the government said, we need more Christian fundamentalist students at Berkeley because it's, you know, too many liberals there. Or we need more Muslim students because it's only 2% of the population at Berkeley. And we had a preference program for that sort of an idea. You would have an outcry and a howl that would not end from black people and from the liberal college professors and on and on and on. So, and I'd like to Ward to address that, because really, when you start this race idea, you know, it's the foot in the door to what's the next preference? What's the next preference after that?
Okay, thank you, Mike. Ward?
Thank you.
I can't embellish upon what he said. He's absolutely right. We say we want diversity, but we never really stop to think what it entails to achieve that. How do you define it? Is it 2%? Is it 3%? 5% of these and 4% of those? I mean, there is no end to it. And if it's not just race, what about religion? What about all those other factors? He's absolutely right.
Do you worry about the fact that some of the people who agree with you are in the shadows and have unsavory views about race and are basically hiding behind you?
You know, I reject that. I've heard that argument before. That gee, they're a racist that are promoting me or not promoting me, but share my views. Well, they're racist on the other side too. There were racists in the South, George Wallace and Lester Maddox, who were Democrats, candidly. What about some of those people who have been fighting me who believe in race? There's no group that has a monopoly on racism. But the people of California who voted for Proposition 209 are not racist. If I'm racist or harbor racism because I believe in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, then there are an awful lot of people in this country who are racist. But this is not a racist view, and it is not driven by racism, and I don't have any worry about the other people's motives. I can only support my own and defend my own position.
We have time for one more call. Raphael from Granite Bay. I'm afraid you'll have to be quite quick, but you're on Insight.
Yes, I wanted to say that while diversity is a goal that is striven for in academic settings and otherwise, the question is what kind of diversity? It should be diversity that's responsive to the level of disadvantage that someone has experienced in their lifetime, whether it's because of their perceived race or because of their gender or sexual orientation. The key should be to achieve diversity that's responsive to disadvantage that they would have experienced in their lifetime. And that could be, based on a number of different factors.
Okay, thank you, Raphael.
I agree with him. I think that if you want to try to get a diverse environment, if you will, at the university, look at the background of students, look at the incomes that they have and different walks of life that they might have come from. We really want the universities to have a composition of people. We want to open the doors to different families. And giving a college education to someone who has never had a parent or someone graduate from college, that does seed that family. But we can do that without conferring benefits on the basis of somebody's skin color or their ethnic background.
And in the minute that remains, do you ever get tired of all this?
Sure do.
So why do you do it?
Because I believe in it. But that doesn't, just because you believe in it doesn't mean that you don't get weary. And often I'm judged solely by this issue here. I've done an awful lot to try to keep fees low. I voted consistently against fee increases. I voted in favor of making sure that same-sex partners had equal rights as employees. Has nothing to do with marriage about same-sex marriage, but it has to do with how do you treat your employees. They're entitled to the same benefits, health benefits and medical benefits, as people who are married, in my opinion. But those things never come up. It's only my contentious issue in defending the use of equality and the principle that everybody should be treated the same and people should not be getting benefits on the basis of their skin color.
We're out of time. Ward Connerly, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
And that's Insight for today. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, obesity is now an epidemic in Mexico, and diabetes is the number one killer there. That story and the day's news are next on The World. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's theme was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley, who's also our music editor. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Insight's executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us. Governor Schwarzenegger's proposal to revamp how teachers are paid is facing resistance. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On the next Insight, I'll speak with experts about how tying teachers' salaries to performance will impact our schools and our students. I'll also speak with a public school representative from Denver, where a merit-based system has already been approved. Join me for Insight.
Monday afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.